Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy Wallace, and I am the host of the show. And today, I have another great, exciting guest on. Her name is Vicki, and Vicki, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, Vicki, my show is about a lot of different things. I try to get a variety of people on, and I have you on for a special reason. And as we go along, I'm sure everybody will understand what that reason is. But, Vicki, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Sure. I am a social worker who works at a child trauma organization in Chicago on the South Side. I grew up in the western suburbs, and I live currently in Chicago.
And so when you say that you worked at a trauma center, maybe explain what you did there and how you helped out.
Sure. I'm the program evaluation coordinator of a trauma program that's part of a national child traumatic stress network. And so what we do there is provide counseling services for kids on an outpatient basis at four different sites, along with providing inpatient consultations for kids who are in the hospital for medical-related trauma, whether burns, motor vehicle accidents, dog bites, those kinds of things. But we are part of this national network of trauma providers throughout the country who specialize in treating trauma and also helping to advance the standard of care for trauma treatment in the country.
Okay. Are there, in your opinion, Vicki, are there other ways that a child can be traumatized, you know, than just like an accident?
Absolutely. And in fact, we see a broad range of kids who've experienced different kinds of traumas based on, you know, their history, whether it's sexual abuse, physical abuse. I think people oftentimes think of those primarily as opposed to the bigger range. We've seen kids who have come here because of Hurricane Katrina, from natural disasters, and also just other gunshot related incidents in communities too. So we see a broad range of kids that come through our doors.
Now, do the kids come and do they stay there, or is it this like an inpatient where they can, an outpatient where they come and they visit and then they leave?
Most of our services are through an outpatient clinic, and there's three locations that we provide services, and then we also see kids who are inpatient at La Rabida Children's Hospital and also at University of Chicago in the burn unit and also the pediatric intensive care unit. So we do see kids inpatient and outpatient, but most of the kids that we see are on an outpatient basis, so they come to us on a weekly basis just for outpatient counseling.
When a child comes by you guys for the counseling, is there like kind of a set amount of time that you know they may have to come, or is it just kind of based upon that individual child?
You know, we're in a very fortunate position. A lot of the mental health systems are set up in a way that caps and limits the amount of sessions that kids can come for services. We're really fortunate that we don't charge for services because of this grant that allows us to offer free services for families who need it. Therefore, we don't have to worry about insurance companies. So really, it's determined by how long it would take the kids to get better and help the family heal in the process of that. So some of the kids we see over years, and some kids are shorter term that we see 3 to 6 months. And I think a piece of it is it depends on what they come to the door and also just how much resilience and support they have to sort of deal with whatever they've come to us with. So,
when you're working with the children, Vicki, have you ever gotten yourself attached to any, you know, any particular scenario?
You know, it's interesting. I've been doing this for over 10 years, not exactly in this setting, but there's always going to be kids and families that you get connected to, that you get attached to, that their story keeps you up at night. But I think a piece of it is realizing that the hope that we provide and helping kids heal and families heal is what makes my job and so much rewarding for me, and also just over time being able to realize there's so many people we're able to help in the course of what we do on a day-to-day basis. But I don't know anybody who says that there's never a family or a child that they don't get attached to in the course of this kind of treatment, or even just treatment itself.
If you happen to get attached to a child or, you know, a family or whatever, after their treatment is done, do you still stay in contact with them?
You know, it's interesting. I have families that still stop by after treatment's over with, that want to stop by to say hello. And I totally believe that families don't end the connection necessarily when the relationship's over with. I am fine with families wanting to keep in touch and letting me know what's happening with them. There are very few families that I have concerns about, and certainly in the course of treatment you would raise issues if there were concerns about us being the only support system for them, and me being the only person they look to for support. But I have families that come back regularly after treatment's over with to say hello and to update me on their child's progress and where they are in school. And it's nice because it allows me to see, again, how they're, you know, supported down the road, and also how they're continuing to have all this resilience and strength too.
To continue. Do you think that children in general have more resilience to continue on than, say, an older person might?
I definitely believe so. As somebody who's worked in child settings and also adult-related services, I think the benefit of working with children is that children are malleable. They're structurally not as set up as adults are, and so the piece of what we're able to do early on and being able to help them heal from a trauma helps them later on in all of their relationships and their development, and also just thinking about their future. And oftentimes what we hear is that families who come through the door, are the adults who are with them, know somebody or even may have their own story of trauma that they never talked about when they were younger, and that still haunt them and impact the way they're able to help their child too. And so, I mean, definitely our philosophy is that if we can help kids talk about this and heal and work through stuff at this point in their lives, they have a better chance of sort of having successful ways of dealing with these related triggers and other things that happen in their life as they move on in their lives.
Okay, now that beep that sounded means that there's a person who called in.
So, okay.
Hello?
Hello?
And can I have your name, please?
Yes, my name is Elaine.
Can you talk just a little bit louder because we can hardly hear you?
Yes, my name is Elaine.
And Elaine, do you have a question?
Yes, my mother, I'd like to know if she has any messages for me.
The only thing is right now, honey, we're probably not going to answer the questions because we're talking a little bit about children and a lot of traumas that they go through.
Can you talk louder? I can just about hear you.
I can hardly hear you again.
Hello?
Hello?
Can you talk louder, please?
That's what I'm saying. I can hardly hear you. So I said what we were doing right now is talking about children and a lot of things that children have gone through. So I'm not necessarily answering any psychic questions at the moment, okay?
Okay.
But thank you for calling.
All right, thank you.
Vicki, when somebody comes to you and their child comes, and the child appears to be afraid to talk like when their parents is there, is there a certain technique that you would use in order to help that child feel a little bit more comfortable with talking about what might be going on?
Well, when families come to us the first session, we don't expect them to tell the story. And depending on the circumstance and the child's vulnerability, sometimes we'll see the parent or the caregiver alone or the child alone. But we never, in the initial sessions, necessarily prod and have the kid tell their story, particularly because a lot of our kids have been through victim-sensitive interviews or had some involvement with the police or Department of Child and Family Services. And so the idea of having them tell their story, when really what we want to do is bolster the resources so that we can talk about it over time, but not necessarily pushing kids right from the get-go to talk about it, is that we would really allow them the space to have to work on it in time. So, you know, depending on the circumstances, we would see the caregiver alone to sort of talk about what happened and to get some background, and then would see the child alone to just sort of introduce the service and what we're there for. All children know that they're coming to us because of something that's happened to them. And so they don't need a retelling necessarily during initial sessions until they may have more resources if they're fairly vulnerable.
If a child has had a very traumatic experience and they and the family come to you, does it usually take maybe 4 or 5 sessions of them coming to you or more before they're actually able to really trust enough or want to talk about what's gone on?
I mean, absolutely. I think a piece of what we work with is that a lot of these families have maybe had engagement with different systems that have not been helpful or been re-traumatized. I mean, a lot of our kids, if they've had contact with, like, the police or other systems that aren't as sensitive to these processes, their line of questioning often blames children for things that have happened to them. So essentially what we say to families is that a certain level of suspicion, I think, is normal, and that we want to be helpful. And so the idea of helping families to come back is to look at barriers that may keep them from coming, and really to be with them in whatever way they can be with us in the beginning. So if it takes a while for a family to warm up, we're like, I think we work with where the family's at too, in terms of their ability and desire to engage us. I mean, certainly we want to help them and their child, and in some families it's a slower process in the beginning than other families. And they may not necessarily in the beginning believe that we are the best solution for them. We have a lot of families, I mean, 95% of the families that we see are African American on the South Side, and we have a lot of Caucasian clinicians, and so there's a piece of faith and church that is important to a lot of our families that they often go to first, and then come to us or want to do it in tandem. And so it's a piece of supporting their spiritual systems at the same time of wanting to engage them around ways that we can best help their child and them help heal from this process.
Okay. What prompted you, Vicki, to want to get into this line of work?
You know, it's really interesting. I think I've always had this sort of service element to who I am. From the time I was 9 on, I was always volunteering in some capacity. And in high school, I started doing a lot more volunteer work and like Meals on Wheels. And I think as I was realizing how much I enjoyed it, I realized that I couldn't be happy in sort of in just an academic kind of setting or being removed from people, that I really enjoyed working with people. And I feel like I have grown in the process of also helping people grow, and that every year it's a humbling experience of recognizing how much people can be helped by what we do and by what I do, and also how I learn so much about families' resilience and children's resilience over time, too, and that it's not just about the helping systems, but it's about helping them see where they have strengths already, too.
Do you think your intuition plays a big part when you first meet a family or a child?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's people oftentimes think in the clinical field that there's certain techniques or you know, certain treatments that are the best. But really, that what we find over time is that the family's ability to engage with you is the primary importance for healing in a relationship. And so there is a piece of understanding or feeling in the beginning whether or not people, the family or the child, are engaged in the process, or if there is more of a stepping back and wanting them to feel comfortable, that's part of this process. So it's not something that's taught in a book or in a class. It's certainly something that you learn over time when you work with families, how they can engage systems, and also what's the best way to engage them in the process of getting their child into care and entrusting somebody with their child.
Have you had to work with ADD, ADHD kids or problem, say, behavior problem children?
You know, and it's interesting. In this setting particularly, we look at sort of behavioral concerns that families may have, attentional issues, concentration issues, but really we look at it from the perspective of when something has happened to a child, what were they like before time and what were they like afterwards? Because a lot of our kids are misdiagnosed with attention deficit disorder when really what they're having is traumatic responses, traumatic triggers to things in their environment, whether it's a teacher having a stern voice at them that reminds them of their parent who was physically abusive to them, those kinds of things that can cause concentration problems. We oftentimes say we would not diagnose those kinds of things unless they've received a course of treatment and we really see what they're like after they have been in counseling for a while and been able to sort of talk about some of the issues. But before this line of work, I worked in more of a community mental health center, and we certainly saw kids that had more concentration, attentional problems. And I think the structure of schools doesn't support these kids who may have, like, just higher activity needs than what our school system supports with 30, 35 to 40 kids in a classroom. And I often worked with Head Start classrooms in Baltimore when I was there about 10 years ago, educating the teachers about ways that these kids could be supported in the classroom and be successful, and that they didn't always have to be behavioral problems that they pointed out, but there are ways that they could help them around supported activities and structured activities that would help the kids focus and also help the teachers so they didn't feel like they were always responding to the kids running around the room or acting out and those kinds of things.
See, I have a nonprofit organization called the Child's Miracle Mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I put it together because of my granddaughter, basically, who from age 2.5 was, my daughter was told constantly that she's got some problems, she needs to be on some kind of a drug, you know, she's not focusing, she's not doing all of these things. And I just got really kind of tired of listening to that,
mm-hmm.
and decided that there's better ways to do things than to put these kids on a lot of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came up with the Child's Miracle Mind, which in the long run will turn into the School of Now, which will also kind of deal with smaller classes, individual, you know, knowing who the individual child is, and mm-hmm. helping that individual child grow at their rate, not because their age is 8 and their mind is at 12 and so they're being held back at age 8.
Right.
You know, so that was one of the biggest reasons why I wanted to talk with you, Vicki, because you have a lot of knowledge about children in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not, you know, I'm not convinced that the schools are actually doing the job that they need to do for all of kids.
Right.
And so that was my biggest question for asking you about the ADD, ADHD, because I think a lot of them are mislabeled and misguided when it comes to, you know, those particular initials, basically.
Well, and I tend to be on the conservative side about all that, too, and I think psychiatrists are too easily doling out medications when really there are a lot of other strategies that could be worked. When I was in Baltimore, I worked with some wonderful psychiatrists that really wanted families to work around behavioral strategies before they'd ever consider it, particularly for kids under 6 years old, because their children's systems are so sensitive, and once you start putting drugs in their system, like regardless of the amount of testing that's been done, we don't know long-term what this does to children's systems. And so there has to be some way that, you know, not just the psychiatrist system, but other systems are working to help the child behaviorally, particularly a 2.5-year-old. I mean, that's pretty astonishing to me that someone would ever say a child at 2.5 has ADHD, because really by diagnostic criteria, they can't even give a diagnosis like that till age 5 or 6. So, I mean, I think that there's a lot of difficulties with understanding how kids operate, and I think they want behavioral control because classrooms are so large. And so, you know, active children are hard for teachers to control. And so it's easy for them to say, you need to do something about it to a parent rather than say, the school can take some responsibility in finding ways to strategize around really active children's needs.
And that I agree with you 100%, believe me.
Yeah.
Now, are you still in school, Vicki?
I am. I'm working on a PhD in public health.
and what would prompt you to continue, you know, to go to school?
You know, it's interesting. I initially started the PhD thinking that I really wanted to do policy work. I was working in child welfare, and I was really distressed with the adolescents that I was working with and sort of how we did a poor job of providing substitute care for them, and that the caregivers that were responsible for them didn't really provide the support, and that I was seeing these kids sort of repeat the patterns of their parents. And so I went in thinking I wanted a public policy degree to sort of help in that navigation of better systems for children and for adolescents over time in that system. But I think what I realize is that there's continuums of ways to help children. And while I'm still interested in policy and still involved in policy at the state and even national level, I think there are other ways to affect those systems too. And so I think what I really wanted was skills to be able to speak a lot of the research talk and to be able to put policy perspectives in context with sort of on the ground what's happening in, you know, treatment settings and counseling settings and also school settings, because sometimes it feels like a lot of it's made by people who don't have any practical experience of working in those systems.
I agree with that one, too. Actually, more than you think. Have you ever thought of or do you now use any form of music when kids come in?
You know, absolutely. I think what we use is what kids bring to us, certainly with little ones that are pre-verbal when things have happened to them, or even who are just little. We use a lot of play. We use a lot of just alternative forms of helping them tell their story and talk about things, not necessarily in verbal ways because they don't have the capacity. So, and even our adolescents, I've had kids who bring music to me as part of telling their story, and it's about what resonates for them as opposed to what I impose upon them. So it really is about the child who comes in the door and what works for them. But we use different mediums all the time.
Does coloring help children to respond in a better way?
You know, for us, we use coloring and drawing to talk about their story. A lot of our kids are stuck in sort of traumatic play where they have repetitive drawings or repetitive play motions that sort of mimic what's happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
And a piece of what we really work on is to help provide an avenue of rescue or escape or help in these repetitive plays. So especially our little ones, but even our older ones, when things have happened to them when they were much younger and they don't have words to put to it, we use drawings to help them tell their story and help them put words to what's happened to them in ways that help them heal and find a way of escape or even rescue in some circumstances for some of our kids who've been really pretty severely hurt when they were younger.
Do you think some form of aromatherapy will also help children to relax?
You know, I think that it's what families are comfortable with, too. I mean, certainly we can have elements of that in our offices with smells. The difficulty is knowing what might be triggers for some kids and other kids. We would have to be careful because if we have smells in our offices for one kid and then have a session afterwards and that same smell could be really triggering for that kid, we just need to be careful about what can be helpful for one may not be for other kids. But I think if families are open to different processes or have even looked into it themselves, really we want to support families where they are around that kind of stuff. And I have had families that really have looked at lavender as being a soothing smell for kids, particularly when they have had nightmares or difficulty sleeping, to help them sleep at night. And it's stuff that they bring to me, but also when they're looking for suggestions of ways that we can help them, it's also things that we might bring up as resources that they could look into.
Do you think, and this is going to sound kind of strange, but do you think, Vicki, that if a family would get together and have an astrology chart done on each individual and then as a family chart, that that might be of some help for all of them to working together to, you know, help out each other, basically.
You know, I personally have never used anything like that. And I think a piece of it would really have to be a family who would feel comfortable, and it's not even something I know very much about. But I think a family who has spiritual systems or belief systems that this is important to them, if they bring it to me or if they, I certainly wouldn't discount it. It's part of their belief system, and I would support them in ways that they can find some meaning from the experiences that they've had too. But it's not something I've ever used myself, mostly because I'm just not very familiar with it. But it's, if it's part of a family or a child's belief system, you know, it's a piece of what the family can look to for resources. You would want to support that, I think.
Great. When it comes to talking with children that have been abused, say, by a family member,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure that it's hard for that child to really talk about anything, because most of the time I would think that the child thinks it's because they did something in order that created it. But when you find that out, the family member, do you also work with the family member as well as the child with that, or is that family member kind of taken out of the picture?
I think it depends on the circumstances in which families come to us. We have a lot of kids in foster care who come who are with relatives or just a foster parent who's not related to them, and so there is a disconnect. We have worked with biological parents when there's a reunification goal, particularly if they've done the work to accept responsibility for what's happened and what they have done for their child and some of that work. The thing about children in foster care is there's often still a gravitation and a pull to their biological family regardless. And so if there's a way that a family could do some of that work and there could be a process of a child being reunified, we would certainly work with the family. But oftentimes we don't have that kind of scenario. We have families that are not able or willing or to engage in systems to really respond to what happened to their child and their responsibility in it and their accountability in it.
Okay. In your opinion, Vicki, what is the hardest type of child to work with who has gone through a trauma?
We've had kids that have had horrible, 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 horrible things happen to them from the time they were tiny until for long periods of time, so that their way of coping over time involves a lot of what we call dissociation, where they're very disconnected from the act, where and sometimes they've created different ways of thinking about themselves or the rest of the world, and sort of splitting off from the event as a way of coping from it. And I think while those kind of children, particularly when they don't have strong attachments or their primary caregiver was not present or neglectful, it's a really hard scenario to work with in terms of if the child's current placement is unstable, if we don't have a caregiver who's willing to sit with that child with all the horror that they've dealt with and work with it and try to work with that child to say, I love you no matter what. Because a big part of what we work with kids who've been in foster care is if they've had multiple placements, they don't necessarily trust that the person they're with is going to be there for the long haul. So some of what's really scary to them about what's happened to them, they may not be able to talk about, as long as they feel like their caregiver can't be there for them or can't sit with them while they're trying to address these issues. And so they can't necessarily consolidate all the ways they sort of split off as a way of coping with what's happened. I think it's a natural response when things happen for kids to do this, but it's over time and when it's been over a longer duration of time that I think a child's attachment system is really disrupted, that we have a hard time really helping children when we don't have caregivers sort of bought into, you know, staying with this child forever to say, I love you no matter what, particularly when there's a lot of behavioral concerns that these kids present with, too.
What is the youngest age child that you have had the opportunity to work with?
At the Chicago Child Trauma Center or just in general?
In general.
I would say 2 with the youngest. And I think a lot of what we do with little ones is a lot of work with the caregiver because the child's response system is so connected to the caregiver that you can't do work with just the child themselves as much as you need to help the caregiver, because really once or twice a week with a child who's 2 years old is not as effective as helping the parent have some tools or caregiver have tools to help the child throughout the week as we're working on healing or addressing behavioral concerns or emotional problems that the child's having.
Have you had to deal with a child that mom was either an alcoholic or into crack cocaine, and there's been, let's just call it residue, for the child to go through?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the kids that I saw a lot in Baltimore, substance abuse was pretty rampant, and so a lot of the kids there had fetal alcohol syndrome, and you could see in their face sort of the change, the structural manifestations of that. But also kids who may not have been born with that, but their parents were definitely addicted, watching their parent sort of go downhill and also not be responsive to them as a parent or caregiver was just devastating to a lot of these kids in terms of understanding what that means. For some of my kids, at least, I had one parent who was able to be responsive, but it was watching the other one not be responsive that was just devastating and grieving, and full of grief for a child, too, particularly when they saw the parent on a regular basis or heard about what was happening with them.
And what's the oldest child that you've worked with?
Well, I guess 21 is still considered a child, so 21-year-old was the oldest.
Is it harder to work with a smaller one, or is it harder to work with somebody who's, like, already 21?
I think, you know, I love all ages of children because there's so many different ways that you can work with kids to help them that are so developmentally based that it's, to me, it's exciting and challenging to work with different age groups. I love adolescents because on some level they have the capacity to think independently. So even if I can't engage a caregiver system as part of the process, at least I can work with the child to sort of, or adolescent to work with what they have and build resources for themselves around like their future. And so it's exciting to see those kids sort of have insight and think about themselves in a way that can support their own future instead of thinking that they have to take what's been given to them. But I also love seeing caregiver systems and children, really small children, work really well together and see how temperament differences between parent and child can be worked on to create a good relationship and a good response system so that children don't get scared when the parent disciplines them, or that they can work well together to have like playtime and just, you know, not just be such a stressed system in general. So I don't really think I have a favorite age, actually.
That's actually good.
Yeah.
Do in your process of working with the children, are they ever put into like small groups or something, like say children that have maybe gone through some of the similar things, are they ever put kind of together so they can talk about it with other children their age?
Absolutely. I mean, I think groups are so helpful for kids because they don't feel so alone and they don't feel so stigmatized. I think going to counseling for some kids feels like they're in trouble regardless of the circumstance. And so having other kids sit around them saying, this is what it's like, or I went through this too, is really helpful, particularly for kids around issues that are really hard or stigmatizing for them in general. I think there are things that kids can give each other or peers can give each other that our therapist role is not maybe as well able to do because they have certainly a generational similarity with each other.
Have you had to work with any cancer children?
You know, I haven't, but I have worked with children whose parents had cancer and where I was helping the whole family system around impending death of a primary caregiver, biological parents. So that was a big piece of sort of what we worked with is understanding that.
When you worked with the children whose one of the caregivers was probably going to end up dying from cancer, did they act more afraid of the unknown, or were they a little bit more, let's say, adjusted as far as accepting what the end result is going to be?
You know, I think no child, whether you're 8, 20, 40, wants to see their parent die. So I think that it's hard regardless. I mean, I think understanding what's happening and not being scared. I think depending on the kid's sensitivity, how much to expose them to some of the medical stuff is important to understand what would be good for the child. But I think having the child be able to say goodbye is really important. I think one of the kids I worked with in Baltimore, we made a point of having the children be able to visit the mom because we knew that she was dying soon. And nobody really wanted them to be in the hospital, but it was really important to the mom, and it was really important to the girls that they got to see her before she died so that they could say they loved each other, because they had had a big fight before she had gone in, and it was really important just sort of for closure for them to be able to say that to each other. But I think a piece of it is like how much information is scary and how much is helpful for certain ages of kids and how much they even understand. They make a lot of these kids' books these days that give child versions of sort of what it's like in the hospital and for different diseases or even cancer that help explain it in kid terms, and that actually on some level you can project the child's feelings onto the characters in the story. And so we use that a lot to help kids sort of understand, but also to be able to talk about things that they just can't or don't feel like they're allowed to talk about by bringing it up in a story of other kids who've gone through things like that.
Have you worked with children who one of their caregivers has already died?
Yes. I mean, I think it's similar concerns in some ways. There's nobody who can replace their biological parent if that's who they were with for a long period of time. And even kids who don't even know their biological parent, like a father who wasn't in the picture, I think for some kids there's still a disconnect of wanting to know who they were and just wanting to know about them, because there's this sense of a gap of not knowing who they are in sort of the constellation of who they are themselves.
In working with children who are not with their parents, if a parent has given up their child at a very young age, and that child has never had the opportunity to meet their parents, have you had to work with children like that?
You know, a lot of our kids are placed with relatives or historically have been placed with relatives, and so there still is some connection, but I think some of our kids, as they get older, they still want to know about their parent. And I've had kids who go out searching for them, even if they've been in a really supportive foster care placement and been adopted, because there's a desire to want to know who their parent was, or at least want to know how they are in those kinds of circumstances.
Vicki, do you think it's important that if a child is adopted, that at some point in time the adopted parent tell the child that they have been adopted, or do you think sometimes it's better off just not known?
You know, I really try to respect caregivers' wishes in a lot of circumstances, and oftentimes what I would do was, you know, address identity issues that really come up in adolescence and young adulthood that kids struggle with, and that knowing some of their history is really important to them. But I would never push any caregiver to talk about it until they are ready to. And I think a piece of it is to understand what their resistance is around telling the children or telling the child, whether it's fear that the child will not love them or fear that they'd want to go back or fear that they're not enough. And I think a piece of it is really to talk to the caregiver about, you know, what are their concerns with telling the child. Because a lot of our kids, particularly if they look very different than their adoptive parents, know that something's different about them, know that there's something that they don't know about their own background, whether it's said or not said.
Have you had to work with children who have been on drugs and maybe overdosed from them or came pretty close to overdosing?
Yes. I worked for, in the state of Illinois, we have a crisis response system called SAS, which is a mobile response when kids are on Medicaid or even foster care kids, that we go out and assess them and determine if they need to be hospitalized or not. And I've had circumstances where I've gone out to the home and really it was a false alarm, and really the child was trying to get the parents' attention and it was about getting them into help. And in other circumstances, it was really dire. It was needed, like a child had already done something or tried something while I was even in the home. And so in those circumstances, it's about calling the police and having them assist with transport. And I think it's pretty scary for me and probably pretty scary for the child and even the family to have a circumstance of, like, police coming in to take a child away. But when they're trying to harm themselves, what we really want to do is keep them safe. And part of our code of ethics as social workers is to do no harm, but also to protect children when they're trying to hurt themselves or other people. And so we have a mandate that we are supposed to intervene in those circumstances, whether getting the caregiver to respond or really calling 911 ourselves. It's really our goal is to preserve children, and oftentimes when they do those acts, it's about a cry for help and wanting to be alive, especially when they let folks know what's happened and they've made outcries in some circumstances that they want this to happen.
Have you ever worked with identical twins, Vicki, that when one of them feels pain or hurt, the other one will feel it too?
You know, it's interesting. I have, and it was two kids that were in the middle of a custody dispute that had gotten really violent between the parents. And it was interesting just to see how they individually coped, but also how they supported each other around the level of conflict in the house. So, yes.
When the twins have that, and you're working with them, are you working with them like individual first and then together? How do you do that?
Well, I think it's a piece is like how old they are. That would determine it. And these kids were like six, so I could work with them individually and together. And I think that the work together was about supporting each other. Again, I come from a perspective that I only see children once a week in a lot of circumstances. And so what I hope to do is to build resources for the rest of the time that they're not with me. And so there's, you know, 6 days, 23 hours, and 24 hours the rest of the week. And so a piece of it is to support, if they could support each other, but also if the caregiver can support the work that we do the rest of the time, it can help kids even faster to do the work that they need to get better.
Have you had to work, Vicki, with a violent child? By that I mean a child who is pretty threatening to other people, you know, like a child who constantly wants to hurt a relative.
I have. I mean, I think in working with a broad spectrum of kids, I've worked from the perspective of kids who just had emotional difficulties, stuff happened in their family, and to kids who had serious mental illnesses, and I think a lot, or were on drugs. And I think what I found is that the kids who who had more psychiatric disturbances that really structurally their system tended to jack things up in terms of they were more aggressive than other kids, or that they had an understanding of things that were really off, like they were really paranoid. Or even if they've been on drugs, it can do that in terms of their brain not processing things right, where they start getting paranoid about people in their household. I have seen that happen and have had to intervene with those kids too. In fact, when I was in Baltimore, we even had to hold kids at times when they became so hurtful that they were going to hurt somebody or even themselves in that circumstance.
Was that real hard to be part of, Vicki?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think even a parent, like I know parents who've had to do this too, but I think it's hard to see your child out of control, and it's hard to be in a situation where people are out of control. And even for the child, like I think a piece of what I realize in all those times is that if I'm nervous in this circumstance, the child must be scared to death because they feel so out of control and don't know what's going on. So I think it's also that understanding of, like, I don't know what can happen next, and I really need to be attentive. And I think this is where my intuition and also, like, understanding sort of safety for myself and other people is important too. I think when I used to do in-home work, a big part of what I would do was sort of survey the surroundings as I'm walking in for, like, points of exit, particularly if I knew that I was walking into a potentially difficult situation, or even for the family to be looking or understanding those kinds of circumstances too. Because I've had some kids that were pretty sick who, when they were off their medications, like, were really violent to people in their household and were dangerous and needed to be, those kids, I think, felt like they needed to be on some medication to help stabilize them.
Have you ever had to deal with a child that has been abducted?
You know, I don't think I have. Not by a stranger. I mean, in custody disputes, I've had kids where the other parent has tried to run off with the children, but not so much a stranger who's taken kids.
In the one where one parent took the child,
mm-hmm.
and you worked with that child, was it hard for that child to understand why the one parent would want to, you know, take them away from the other parent?
Absolutely. I mean, I think they're super confused about what was going on and why they're going to this location instead of where they were supposed to go. And I think a piece of it is, like, why is Daddy doing this? Why can't Mommy and Daddy just work it out? Why can't Mommy and Daddy just live together? And I think it's just the confusion that kids have when they really want the idealized system to be back the way it used to be, which is both parents living in the same household, and they don't understand why they're having to go away.
Do you think, Vicki, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to.
Okay.
Do you think if in a family there are some kids and the marriage itself is just really, really horrible, like, say, they're very abusive to each other, they may throw things at each other, or they may try to, like, really hurt each other, do you think it is better for a child to stay? Well, I shouldn't say that. Do you think it's better that a couple stay in a relationship like that because of the children in their mind, or do you think it would be better if they would just separate and then kind of, like, work things out?
You know, it's interesting because I think every family circumstance is so different, and I think it depends on people's financial resources in a separation process. Also, like, what are the incentives to stay together, and if there was anything workable. I mean, if one of the partners is highly abusive to the other partner in the relationship, it doesn't support a child's development, and it's not going to support a child's healthy view of a relationship necessarily to see parents in such conflict. However, you know, people are in all different circumstances, and a piece of it is, like, what can you realistically do? Because it's expensive to divorce, and it's expensive to start the process. And not to say that I'm stating that people need to stay together because of the money, but I think there is a reality that comes to bear in a lot of circumstances when that happens, of what it means for that actually to happen, and also what it means for the child to be going back and forth between parents if that is what ends up being the arrangement. And, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, for me, a lot of it plays a part in how old the child is, like what level of violence or conflict has happened in the household, like if there's a way that caregivers can work things out. When I was in Baltimore, I was working with a Children of Separation Divorce Center, and a big part of what they were doing was really trying to create a system where the judicial system, the courts, the judges, the attorneys, really looked at what the needs of the child were instead of the parents' issues and concerns with each other, because oftentimes in divorce and custody disputes, the focus oftentimes is about the parents and not necessarily about the child. And I think this child-focused decision-making model was really about saying, like, what will help the child the best? Will shuttling back and forth be the best? I mean, obviously the best situation is that a child could be in the same household with both parents and be able to wake up with both of them in the same household. But if it's so conflict-laden, and if there's a level of violence that's gotten escalated over time, you know, from a child perspective, that may not be the best scenario either. So I think a big part is assessing and understanding what the parents are capable of doing, and how much they're able to sort of look at their circumstances and the ways to support the child in that process.
Do you think it's advisable for parents, since we're kind of on that topic, if they cannot get along together, to separate until they get whatever they need to have worked out, and then go back into the marriage again, and then see it's not going to work again, and then separate, and the kids are the ones who keep doing or seeing this back and forth thing?
Yeah.
How hard do you think that would be on the children?
You know, I really would hope in circumstances that where these things are going on that they would get some outside help. Like, I think sometimes I think relationships are really hard anyways. From friends who I know and people in my life who've been in relationships for over 20, 30, 40 years, I think that they say it's hard work. And so I think a piece of sometimes when people get stuck in circumstances where they don't know how to get out of it, but they're not necessarily giving up on their relationship, that they would seek someone else to help sort of work on things together because they're so stuck in their own patterns. And in circumstances like this, I would really hope that they would get someone to help them figure out the best way to support the children in their own process together, which is, does it make sense for me to continue to come back, or do we put limits? How much do we tell the children? Like, that kind of information that would help the child so much more, but also would support the caregivers creating an arrangement that would work best for them and for the kids in sort of the bigger picture.
Once you finish with your college, Vicki, are you going to go back to college and do some more studies, or do you think that's going to do it for you?
I think I'm in school way too long. I think this is the last degree I'm planning to get. I mean, I think I'm an eternal student in that I believe that every day there's so much to learn, and I don't think I'll ever stop learning. But I think a PhD is certainly the top of the heap, and I don't intend to get any more degrees in my future.
We're almost out of time, Vicki, so
okay.
Just quickly, if you could sum up what you think the most important part of all of your training has been, where do you think that would be?
Wow.
I heard that, oh wow.
You know, I think I've realized over time that families and children have taught me so much about just their capacity to heal, but also their ways of helping to navigate the healing process. And I'm continually humbled on a day-to-day basis about how I am there as a guide to partner with families and children in their process of healing. And I am in wonderment on a regular basis about how these families and children are survivors and resilient in the face of so much difficulty and adversity. And I think a piece of what I hope every day is that I learn and continue to understand how much resources families bring to me before I see them, and that I'm not there to help to provide the grand fix, but they have a lot of resources already that I can help them to look at in the process of healing themselves.
Vicki, our time is actually up. It has been my pleasure to talk with you.
You too.
I wish you the best success with
Thank
what
you.
You're doing, and keep doing it.
Okay.
Because we do know that the children need all this help, okay?
Okay.
All right, Vicki, you take care.
You too.
And I'd like to thank you, the listeners. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation for today. May God bless all of you. Have a great week, and we'll talk later. Take care. Bye now.